Hello, and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Lillian Nakagawa, a member of the club's Asia-Pacific Affairs Forum, and your chair for today's program. Today's program is The Sake Revolution, Sequoia Sake, by Mr. Jake Myrick, the co-founder of Sequoia Sake. This is the second of three Japan food talks co-sponsored by the Consulate General of Japan in San Francisco. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce Mr. Akira Ichioka, Director Counsel of the Consulate General of Japan in San Francisco, who will introduce our speaker this evening. Mr. Ichioka?
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us for the second installment of our three Japan food series. My name is Akira Ichioka. I'm consul in charge of public relations and culture affairs at Japanese Consulate in San Francisco. As Lillian introduced, beginning of this month, we had Mr. James Freeman of Blue Butter Coffee, and we really enjoyed his talk. And today, we have another innovator in the local food scene in the Bay Area. I'm honored to have Mr. Jake Myrick, co-founder of Sequoia Sake, the first sake microbrewery in Northern California. He lived and worked in Japan for 10 years and has brought his passion of sake back to the Bay Area. He, with his wife Noriko-san and a good friend Warren Fowl, started Sequoia Sake in 2014. So sake is becoming really trendy in the Bay Area, and now you can find Sequoia products in trendy establishments like State Bird Provision, Liho Liho Yacht Club, and Izakaya Ko, and many others. And luckily, we are able to taste his sake after his talk today. So please welcome Mr. Jake Myrick.
I like that introduction. Thank you very much. Good evening. I'm just going to switch off the slideshow here for a second. Thank you for coming. I really appreciate it. I'm going to talk a little bit about sake, talk a little bit about the Bay Area, and talk a little bit about Sequoia. But to get started, I'm going to talk about Sequoia first. Seems to be the first question most people want to ask me is why the name Sequoia? Well, we looked around and we tried to find something that was iconically California. The reason we did this was we wanted to make sure people recognized us as being California, not from Texas and not from Japan. So we chose Sequoia. This actually is the symbol there that says katakana that says Sequoia. That's our stamp for Sequoia. So we are the first artisan sake microbrewery in California, but we're not the only ones. In 2010, there was 14 other ones. Right now, there's anywhere between 18 to 26 that they're talking about right now. Who are we? That's always another good question. There's three of us. Myself, I'm the one who came back from Japan and decided we needed to do this. Then there's Noriko. She's been in the IT business, like myself, for more than 25 years. And then there's a third person, Warren Fall. He was in the IT business, but got smart enough and got out and started to make cabinets and other things with his hands. What's not said on this slide right here is the relationships between each of us. As was mentioned just a little while ago, Noriko also is my wife of over 20 years. Warren, I've known since I was 12 years old. What's interesting about that, though, is this is the third business I've actually done with Warren, and his wife still lets me in his house. I have a daughter who's 20 years old. She's going to college and deciding what to do with their life and all this stuff. So we were cleaning out the garage the other day, and we found this photo here of a bicycle. And she's like, hey, what's that? I said, that's Mount Everest. She's like, what? I go, yeah, that's Mount Everest. I was the second person to cross from Lhasa into Kathmandu on a bicycle. This was many years ago. They just opened it up. But what I wanted to point out here was many people ask me, how do you go from being IT into making sake? So I just tried to list top 10. I was born in New York. I don't mean to offend anybody who's still living in New York. I escaped. But while I was there, I worked for my father, who started the first service bureau. And we had to get the car. I had to work in the service bureau. So that's how it all got started. I also was fortunate enough to go to Japan many, many years ago. And I got a scholarship to study at Osaka University, where I studied parallel processing. This was before the iMac. So this was very, very important back then because you needed to render all kinds of interesting things. When we started there, it was in a room the size of this, all filled with all these processors. When I left 6 months later, it was the size of a laptop. So I bicycled through the Himalayas. That was a small event. I nearly died, but it was fun. Never want to go back there again. It's kind of romantic, but anyways. Moved back to California, but I was living in Los Angeles, and I tried to convince my wife, who was living in Belgium, of course, chocolate, beer, good life, you know, come live with me in L.A. She didn't like that much. So she was the one who gave me the ultimatum. If I was going to live in America and not Europe and not Japan, she had to live in San Francisco. So you can thank her for why we're here. I then started a bunch of companies. I've actually started about 10 different companies, both here in the U.S. and in Europe and in Japan. Probably my most successful one, or both most noteworthy one, was I started an edutainment company. Those of you that can remember that. That was many years ago. So we had these things called CD-ROMs. We were the first company to sell over 1 million CD-ROMs. That was a lot back then. Then after that, my wife did marry me. We moved here, had a child, and my wife decided that we needed to have my daughter. My wife is Japanese. We need to have my daughter get immersed into the culture. So we did the 3-year program to go back to Japan. Ended up staying 10. I missed all the bush years. I'm sorry to say that. So my daughter is in her 8th grade. She decided she doesn't want to go through any more Japanese education. She's decided she wants to come back to America. So I sell off my business in Japan, and I come back here, and I start another business. And I didn't really like that business very much, so I started working for a nonprofit educational business. Most people of my age, my contemporaries, when we leave the IT business, we kind of either go into the food business or we go into the educational business. In the same time, this is 2010, I started to make sake in my garage because 99% of all the sake that comes in from Japan is pasteurized. And my favorite sake is unpasteurized, or otherwise known as namazake. So I wanted to drink that. So I started making it in my garage. That worked out okay, but it wasn't really stable. So I started to look around where I could actually get some, and I found there was another 14 other micro sake breweries, and I started to visit them to see what they were doing. I ended up in Vancouver with this gentleman, Masa, who owns the Artisan Sake Brewery. And he's the one who took me under his wing and convinced me I could do this, and my wife wouldn't leave me. So far, so good. So I want to talk about the sake revolution. It's kind of a strange topic when you're talking to people that are from Japan, talking about a revolution of an alcoholic beverage that's been around for 2,000 years, you know. But here in America, it actually is a revolution. I mean, it's incredibly steeped in the culture in Japan. It's been there for so long, everyone just takes it for granted. It is a hidden gem of a product that is finally beginning to see the light of day here in America and also in Europe. In the last 3 years alone, it's grown 17%. That's better than any other alcoholic beverage. Well, I'm not talking about micro sake breweries. I'm talking about the whole industry. So I wanted to take that, and then I wanted to look at San Francisco. So the Silicon Valley has this home of the startups. Everyone thinks about the startups. But what most people don't realize, it's not just about the startups. It's the mentality of all those startup people that are here. I'm never asked, well, how does somebody from the IT business think that they can make sake? they all say, hey, let's give it a shot. Let's try it. And that's why this area is so unique. Another unique aspect of this area is the ones that I'm listing right here, the industry innovators. Back in the 70s, nobody drank wine. We had cocktails. You went to a restaurant, maybe an Italian restaurant, you'd order some wine. It wasn't until the Judgment of Paris, where they did the blind taste testing, that actually wine started to be given as gifts. And it slowly moved into the home, and now it's a beverage everyone drinks pretty much every day and without even second thoughts. It's the same with the bread industry. We take it for granted here living in the Bay Area. We started it. The same with the coffee industry, and the same with the chocolate industry, and I'm hoping the same with the sake industry. This is another interesting, you know, I'm from the IT, so I read these reports all the time. This is a report that, I can't remember who it was, I think it was Stanford that came out and said, you're more likely to succeed with your startup here in San Francisco or Silicon Valley than any place else in the world. And they listed all the, you know, pieces of evidence that gave that, you know, the short name, access to capital, access to resources. But I really think they missed the biggest piece, is it's the environment here. Everyone is willing to try and experiment. And that's really key for us. We are able to get our product out there because people are willing to accept it for a product that they'll try. But back to reality. The decision-making tree, you know. I had to convince the wife that I wasn't going to lose the house. Yes, we own a house in San Francisco. We bought it many years ago, so I had to make sure. So we go through the tree. We want to find something that is competitive, but yet is growing. Sake is a growing industry, and we are just a few steps ahead of the competition. We are in a big boom. San Francisco is the third largest sake-consuming city outside of Japan. First comes New York, L.A., San Francisco. Chicago and Atlanta kind of fight for fourth place, but it's okay. They can keep fourth place. We like San Francisco. We wanted to create a product that had the right price point that could support us. It's a very expensive city, as we all know. Luckily, sake is very expensive here. Not as expensive. In Japan, it's much cheaper, but we've grown to have the price point that supports this industry. Also, what supports this industry, in my belief, is the beer is actually a really price point. Craft beer is a high price point also here, and good wine has a good price point. So that was really nice for us. The second piece was we wanted to create a barrier for entry. So there are no sake magazines, no sake books, no sake anything written in English that you can start up a brewery here. You actually have to go back to Japan to learn the process to actually do it correctly. There's a bunch of people learning how to do beer. Beer is a grain just like sake is rice. Rice is a grain. There's similarities, but not all similar. So you really do need to go back to Japan to actually get some of the basic understanding. Also wanted to make sure that we had someplace people were willing to talk to us. And San Francisco has that food culture, so a lot of restaurants that we went to were really interested in seeing us. Okay, so I was in the education business, and I was trying to get out of it. Now I'm back in the education business. Our research showed that we need to make people understand or at least have access to understanding what it is, okay? So I spend a lot of time, even with people that know sake, explaining that sake is not a distilled beverage. It actually is closer to wine. Okay, I can understand the lame person not understanding that, but believe it or not, California thinks we are a winery. So when you come to visit my brewery, I have a wine license and welcome to my winery. The federal government, on the other hand, thinks that we're a brewery. So yes, I had to get both licenses. Not so bad. The lawyer said 3 months. It took us 9. He said $500. It was more than $5,000. So it's okay. The hard part, though, is that the people that think we're a brewery actually review our labels. Our labels are wine labels. So it's always interesting to me when I submit my label and I say made in San Francisco, and they say, you can't say that. The consumer is going to get confused that the grapes you're using are from San Francisco. I kid you not. I'm just hoping that someday we can actually have a craft sake section and actually have a specialist that understands what sake is. We're working towards that. We do spend a lot of time doing education. So we conduct a lot of seminars, and in fact, every retailer that's come and selling our product has sent their staff to come through our 90-minute presentation of understanding what basic sake is, which is really, really needed and also great appreciation. Okay, branding. Of my many talents that I've done and gone in different places, I actually worked for the company that designed the Heineken label when I first got out of college. It was a great, great opportunity. I also have a fine art degree, but I don't ever use, so all the labels are actually my characters. That helped. So we created these characters so that people would remember them, even if they forget the Sequoia, even if they forget Genshu, Nama, or Noguri. Everyone that's gone to Disneyland remembers where they parked their car, under Dumbo. There's another couple pieces that we looked into the research also. When you're looking at a Japanese sake label, there's lots of beautiful calligraphy on there, lots of beautiful design, but it's very difficult for the American consumer to remember the name of the sake they just drank, let alone the style. So what we did was we created a style, which is the Genshu, Nama, and Nigori, and we put it in very simple terms. We took a lot of the extra language off the bottle and made it very clean and simple so that people could understand it quickly and relate to it. There was a couple other pieces here that we also did. We changed the bottle shape. So instead of a 730, we went with a 750 size, and we went with a 375 size. We found from our research that the consumer knew how much they were going to drink when they got a half a bottle of wine, so they wanted to have that same piece. The clincher was, though, when you look at the history of sake over the last 3 years, has been growing in gift-giving. All the bags to give your friends a gift is a wine bottle bag, so we needed a wine bottle. Okay, here's the secret sauce. Get your notes out. It takes 20 years in Japan under apprenticeship before you can make your first batch of sake. I'm not going to wait that long. So there was three of us. We decided to break it up and make sure that we all hit as many pieces of the pies as we could. So Noriko spent the last 3 years, well, actually since 2010, she spent 3 years before we ever got started learning about koji. There's two parts of the sake making process. You have koji, which is a mold that converts the starch to sugar. You need to convert the starch to sugar before you can make sake because the yeast needs the sugar. But this koji is a very finicky animal, and you need to really understand that. So she spent a full 3 years engulfed in just learning how to do that. My other partner, Warren, who is the master craftsman, built everything inside of our facility, from the tanks to the chiller on the roof to the curb, every aspect of it. He actually did all the paneling on there. He actually built the koji room. He understood all the plumbing and was able to get that done. He spent a lot of time working with the Japanese engineers. Yes, we hired Japanese engineers to come over and actually lay out our facility, and he worked with them to understand exactly what needed to be done because we have to manufacture 99% of everything we have there. There is no sake supplier in America, and everything we'd buy from Japan, well, 2 years ago, got stuck on a boat outside Long Island for a couple of months. I mean, outside Long Beach for how many months? But we won't go into that. So he did that. After that, I pretty much did everything else. I talked to all the lawyers, did all the design, learned all about the fermentation. So I was going back and forth to Japan and up to Vancouver, learning just about the fermentation and the bottling and all the other aspects of that. So all of last year, it was just myself. My other two partners were still working their day jobs. So they came in when we needed to do bottling or we needed to do pressing. Sake is pressed just like grapes and just like olives. So once it's done fermenting, we put it into these bags. We put it into a press, a hydraulic press, and it squeezes out the sake. A couple other key pieces here. San Francisco is a fantastic market. It's my home. I love it. If you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. I stole that from New York. Yes, I was born in New York. It's okay. But it's also a really difficult market. It has the first sake shop of any place in the United States. They've been here for 7 years. There is a lot of premium sake here. So we had to make sure that we had a product of really high quality and caliber to even make it in this market. So before we got started in 2013, we sent back the rice we decided to use, which is Calrose, local rice, and we sent back water analysis. We did water analysis throughout the Bay Area and San Francisco One. We're really happy with that. So we're using Hetch Hetchy water, and the other reason that we're using Hetch Hetchy water in San Francisco is it's consistent. Alameda's water system changes throughout the year, and so does Oakland and many of the other areas, so we couldn't have that. So we sent this back to two labs in Japan, and they sent us back the koji, which we use to convert the starch to sugar, and they sent us back the yeast, which we use to convert the sugar to alcohol. So we then had the components that we needed to make a premium product, which was really, really key for us. We also spent a lot of time making sure we had relationships with many, many different breweries in Japan to make sure we had somebody we could ask questions to, because we were going to have problems. We knew it. All the training we did in Japan, also, we did it at small mom-and-pop breweries. We did not want to do it at the big breweries. We wanted to know what happens when the washing machine breaks and how does he fix it. It has to be that level. We also did a couple other pieces. We wanted to make sure when we first hit the market, it was in places that people would recognize as premium. So many of the locations we first went to, we were the first sake they had. We educated them about what sake was, how to use it, how to serve it, how to keep it. And then because they were such premium brands, that premium brand came back onto us. So that's what we did to make sure we had the quality product here in San Francisco. One of our first ones and our most favorite one that is very supportive of us is Liholiho. They have done very well with our sake, and they are now carrying other sake, which is very nice. That's what we've been, that's why we came here. We wanted to have a sake that people could understand, get appreciation of, and then experience more sake. We went Byright. Byright was carrying one sake for cooking, but they had no sake. I was a little nervous about Byright, even though they are a quality product. They didn't have the experience. Their staff, their alcohol staff, is second to none. They really know their wine. They know their spirits. So we actually brought them all in for a presentation and did a seminar with every single person inside their organization. 90 minutes, over 140 people, I believe, came through that presentation. We have a great relationship with Dandelion Chocolate. Sounds a little crazy to most Japanese to think that you actually could pair chocolate with sake. This event has been sold out, and we've been adding seats through the rest of the year. It is one of the most popular events, so says Dandelion. They are really ecstatic about this because it brings out flavors that they didn't know were in their chocolate. We're ecstatic about it because their chocolate brings out flavors in our sake we didn't know, which is a perfect pairing. This is an incredible course, just absolutely amazing course. I just love it so much. And Dandelion, I can't talk enough about them. They have the best chocolate in the world. Feastly. This was another strategy we had. We wanted to get pop-ups. So if anyone's not familiar with this, this is an organization that has chefs that focus on a theme, and they go to different locations or they use the Feastly location. This gentleman here, Jeff Reed, he actually takes our sake kasu, which is the leftover after we press the sake, the lees, and he makes a chocolate vegan mousse. It's to die for. Oh my goodness. It is just incredible. He takes our sake and does amazing pairings. And we do this event once a month also. But it was a great way to reach out to the population in another venue. The third or the fourth one that we spent a lot of time was, I'm from the IT world, so I spent a lot of time talking to my IT colleagues. And I give seminars at IT companies, and we do events inside the brewery, team building events. There is a thirsty market out there wanting the knowledge, wanting the education about a product that they only could ever experience usually in a Japanese restaurant. So being able to have a brewery right there, and we're brewing every day of the year, 24/7, we've got product in the tank that you can actually see, smell, and taste, which is really, really important for them to come in and actually experience it. Just like Napa, we're hoping that having that closeness and that experience helps them understand and appreciate sake. Okay, here's my IT gig. So in Japan and when I was up in Vancouver, the koji making process and the sake making process is very sensitive to temperature, humidity, and everything. And most of the old guys over in Japan would go and take a thermometer, stick it into the koji, stick it into the product, write it on a piece of paper, and at the end of the day, kind of log it down. I just couldn't do that. There is lots of high-tech stuff out there for beer and lots of high-tech stuff out there for wine, but I could not find anything that met the requirements I needed for a sake. I went to the pharmaceutical companies, and that's where I got the Hobo system. So this is a pharmaceutical lab system that monitors all my stuff. So I'm able to sit at home now instead of sleeping at the brewery and check it on my laptop. I love San Francisco. What makes us unique? The people here. Being able to come in and experience this, coming through and giving us the support, that's what makes this unique. We want to be local. We spent a lot of time researching our rice. We're using all local rice. We've been working with rice farmers. If this drought wasn't here, we'd have our own rice, but it's killing us. So hopefully we're on track with the drought to be able to start growing our own rice next year. We have the Yosemite water. The researchers in Japan said the water was fantastic. They thought the mineral content would make it a nice soft sake, which is what we wanted. They said you only had to remove the iron. So we have oversized iron filters to remove all the iron. What we also wanted to do was really focus on unpasteurized sake. To me, that has the biggest flavor, the biggest ability to give you that real sake experience. And the only way we could do that was to actually manufacture it here. We could not import it. We wanted to locate close to the consumers to allow the consumers to actually come in and see it. We also wanted to spend a lot of time working with the restaurants and making sure they understood not just the sommeliers and not just the alcohol staff, but everyone throughout the whole chain, what is unique about sake. Here's a few places we are. I actually have not updated it lately. So in 2013, we sent over our analysis. In August of 2014, we started our build out. In May of 2015, we did our first sales. So we just celebrated our first year of sales, and we're in, I think it's like 19 different restaurants and 19 different retail locations. We've only focused on the Bay Area right now. We will have other products, and we are talking to distributors throughout the rest of California. And that's it, until we come to the questions.
Thank you, Jake. So now it's time for questions, your questions and answers. If you'd like to ask a question, please raise your hand, and Cynthia will bring you the microphone. Great.
Hi, a short question. Does your product require refrigeration?
Yes, our product requires refrigeration. That's a really great question. It's like food. You would not buy milk and leave it out and then drink it the next day. This is live product. Our product is, we say, 3 months shelf life. So that means when you buy it and you keep it in your refrigerator, you should drink it within 3 months. All sake should be consumed within 1 year, okay? But if you once you open the sake, it's good for about 5 days to a week in the refrigerator if you put the cap back on and leave it in there. We're making sake every 42 days. So we really tell people, do not buy sake if you're going to keep it for 3 months. Buy it when you're going to drink it.
Another short one. Just in case you don't finish that bottle in the first night, like wine, if you vacuum it out or put a nitrogen blanket on it, does it age any better? Or does it survive?
Nitrogen is by far better than just taking the oxygen out. But it's still, you're talking like 5 days, you should really pretty much consume it. You may buy yourself a half a day.
We're passing your sake around. Can you tell us what we're tasting?
You're trying the Nama. The Nama, they're all Nama, but this is our house sake. This is the one we worked with a couple chefs to make a product that is pairs well with a wide variety of foods. So this is unpasteurized sake. It actually will change its flavor profile as the food that you eat. So if you eat with a salad, it tends to have a little bit of a fruity flavor. If you're eating it with cheese, it tends to have a more yeasty flavor. So it pairs really well between everything from salads all the way up to lightly spicy dishes.
I have a question. What elements of sake making differentiate the different qualities, or what differentiates the different flavors that you get from the different kinds of sake?
Well, just like wine, rice is really, really important. So we're using Cal Rose, which is a local California rice, which actually came over. They've been not modified. It's been grown in bred to be a really robust product. I went to California Rice Growers Association to ask them about the rice because the analysis came back and said that there's actually a really big starch center. And the Japanese were asking, how can there be a big starch center? This is table rice. All table rice in Japan has a very small starch center. So I went up there and asked them, and they said in the 1920s, when the Japanese farmers came here, they brought rice for their table and rice to make sake. And the rice to make sake somehow got into the gene pool of the rice that we call Cal Rose. Luckily for us, not so much for the people eating it, but I'm happy with that. So that's one aspect. Another aspect is how much you mill it. All of our rice is considered premium quality sake, so we take off 40% of the outside. The reason we do that is you want to remove all the oils, which can go rancid, and then you want to remove all the minerals, and then you start removing some of the protein. The more you remove the protein, the cleaner the flavor. So the next level up is Dai Ginjo, where you remove 50% of the actual rice, and that means you're much closer to just the starch. That really impacts the flavor also.
About pasteurization.
Yes.
What are the advantages and the disadvantages of using that technique in production of sake?
The biggest advantage is you stabilize the product right there and you make it available for shipping. In a hot climate like Japan, that's really essential. You can't keep a product that's live and could go deteriorate if it gets too warm. The disadvantage of sake that gets pasteurized is you have to know exactly when to pasteurize it to maintain the highest quality flavor. Also, usually when you pasteurize, you then do a second step, which is called a charcoal filtering. When you use charcoal filtering, you're taking out all the bad stuff, but you're also taking out some of the good stuff too. So you actually can truncate the flavor, which is why I like Namazake the best. It has the biggest flavor.
This is good.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate that. Tell your friends.
Do you distribute your kasu as well?
We have not commercially been distributing our kasu. My partner occasionally takes it out to some farm markets and sells it to the end consumer. San Francisco mandates that we can't sell the small tubs in the city. We can only sell it at the farmer's market. But we do sell the large tubs because we can sell those to the restaurants. We're looking at doing more with that right now. So we have a bunch of different partners that we're talking with to do more with the sake kasu. Yeah.
And are you not allowed to sell the kasu because it's alcoholic? Or
no, it's a health issue.
Oh, health. I see.
I have to get a kitchen, and the kitchen staff has to be approved by the California San Francisco Health Department, and they have to have the gloves and put it on and put it in the little containers. But at a farm, I don't have to do that.
And what is the alcohol content of your sake?
The sake you're drinking right now is 14.75% alcohol. It actually is blended down, and the yeast we're using is a fruit yeast, so it has a little bit of a fruit flavor. The genshu, which we don't have here, is about 18% alcohol. That has not been diluted down, and we use a floral yeast. And the sake kasu has about a 3% alcohol.
The material that you use to turn the starch into sugar, that's called?
Koji.
Koji. I presume there's not an English name.
There is, but it's got to be a Roman name or whatever. It's a long name.
And is it used by or for any other purpose?
There's thousands of different types of koji. Our koji is very specific to making sake. We're getting it from a house that's been doing it for over 600 years, making this kind of koji just for sake. But koji is used to make soy sauce, miso. In Korea, it's made to make shoju. In China, it's made to make all kinds of other alcohol and food-related products. It's been being used for thousands of years.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hey.
I understand that, how would you say, the distribution of the growth of sake in Japan is going down.
Yes.
While it's going up here. So I'm wondering, you know, is there any kind of cultural interchange that's going on between you and Japan still that is contributing or has any kind of impact from that?
I have a lot of support, as you can see, Japanese consulates here. Over the last 5 years, 200 sake breweries went out of business in Japan. Only one new one started. We had almost, 10 start here, so we're hoping that. I have a lot of Japanese brewers coming through our facility here. We're really fortunate because this is the place they land first when they're coming on their sales tour, so they come and talk about this. There's hope that we can reinvigorate the Japanese culture. It's the young kids coming up right now. They want to drink beer. They want to drink wine. They want to, you know, drink all these other popular drinks. I don't think they realize or don't want to pay attention to the cultural history of sake right now. And I think the craft industry here is used to that. That's why it's becoming big here. We all appreciate this craft. I mean, it's a lot of work to make sake, a lot of work. But so the young people don't really want to make that because it's a lot of work over there also. So I'm really hoping. I think everyone here is hoping that we can reinvigorate that.
Hello. Yeah, being we are in California, San Francisco Bay Area, and the words sustainability and organic and all those things come up, and I mean, you know, you hear it everywhere you go. Any kind of thing that's produced now, people want to know, you know, how it's produced and the source of it. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. California has one of the most rigid agricultural industries in the whole United States. So our rice is not organic. We don't use organic. It would be double my cost right now. I do see people wanting to make organic, but when I talk to the other big sake producers and ask them how much of their organic sells, it doesn't sell that much better than their regular sake. I will stand behind the rice. The rice producers that we talk with, they have all the statistics of what they're using on that rice. So it is all natural. It is sustainable in terms of what they call sustainable. You know, it is a low impact on the environment. The amount of water, we actually practice dry farming, which is not practiced in Arkansas. They use wet farming in most of Japan. So they actually wet the paddies, plant the seeds, and slowly take it off until they need to fertilize it again. Then they bring the moisture back up. So they are really, really conscious about what they're doing here. I feel fortunate in San Francisco and California that we do have such a very proactive industry.
Can you elaborate a little bit on the koji and the yeast starter? What happens to those once you, I think you said you sent it off to get the original koji made. Does it come back and then you nurture it from here, or how does that work?
Good question. Actually, we do everything at our facility except mill the rice. We grow the koji on the rice. So what we sent over to Japan to the two labs was the actual Cal Rose rice. So they went and did their analysis on that, whatever they do, and they sent us back the koji king, which are the spores of the koji. So we're actually seeding the koji into the rice. That process actually takes 3 days, and it's a very delicate process. So we actually do all that. The yeast is another one. There's 24 different varieties of yeast, and then there's sub-varieties on top of that. And each different province in Japan has a co-op that holds those yeast specifically to those provinces. So I can't tell you where I get my yeast because then everyone else will know which province I'm getting from. Yes, it really is. It really is. Yeah.
My question is, can you give some tips on sake tasting or what are key elements we should look for?
Key elements. So I do a class on, you know, sake 101, and this is always the question, what are the five buzzwords you need to know? Junmai. Junmai is my biggest complaint out there. Junmai is the first question you should ask. Junmai means that it is all natural, only water, rice, koji, and yeast. Nothing else has been added. No alcohol, no sugars, nothing else has been added. If they don't say it's junmai, something's been added. Nama. Nama is my second big word. If it's nama, it means it's fresh and unpasteurized. Okay? You have to have fresh if you have nama. That means it hasn't been sitting on the shelf. And you should also ask, how long has it been sitting on the shelf? All sake coming from Japan has a date on it. our friends at the federal, whatever those people that do my labels, won't let me put a date on it because it's a wine label. Yes, I can put a vintage. I'm not sure what that would do, but I can put a vintage, but not a date. Another one is Genshu. Genshu is my favorite drink because it's straight out of the tank. That means it's the full flavor. They haven't diluted it. They haven't blended it down with any water. So those are pretty much the key words you want to know. The next level down is Ginjo. Ginjo means it's been milled to at least 60%, so the 40% is taken off. Dai Ginjo is where they've milled it 50%. I hope that helps.
Hi. Can you explain why some sakes are served cold and some are served warm?
Good question. The sake you're drinking here is actually blended to be cold, served on ice, and very chilled. Most all nama is cold. It's coming out of the refrigerator. It should be cold. Genshu, our Genshu, I tell people take it out of the refrigerator about 20 minutes before you eat, set it on the table, get it just a little bit warmer. Our sake also, we've done a little bit different blending of it. So most sake in Japan, they use one koji and they use one yeast. We actually use three kojis because I wanted a bigger bouquet. So you actually have a smell there. Most sake has very little smell, very little aroma. I wanted that smell because we like hoppy beers and big red wines. So we have to compete against that. The other piece here is that the warmer it gets, a little bit more of the lactic acid comes out in sake, and it becomes a little bit more buttery. So I tend to like that, but some people don't. So it depends on your taste buds. It goes well when you're having more spicy foods. You want it to have a little bit more lactic acid, so it cleans your palate. Another aspect that we did, we actually made our sake a little bit more acidic. So it's a little bit more like wine, so it actually also cleans your palate a little bit.
So two quick questions. You've touched a lot on sake education throughout the talk, and I was wondering if you foresee a time when maybe like a professional organization like a sommelier or a Cicerone program would be necessary to educate people in high-class restaurants and other organizations. And then also, what's the biggest brewery mishap you've experienced?
The biggest brewery, sorry, what was that? Mishap? Oh, mishap. We'll start with that one. Our friends PG&E, they're supposed to call me when they shut off the power. They didn't. So now my system is all hooked up so that I know when the power goes off. That was a friendly person. And because I'm 1 year into my business, I don't have historical data to show them how much they cost me. They wouldn't reimburse me. So back to your first question. Sorry. Oh, there actually is a lot of sake sommelier programs right now. John Gertner is probably the biggest one here in the States, and that is becoming more and more popular. All the distributors we've been talking with all have their own sake sommeliers right now. That is significantly different than what I went for training. So they have the vocabulary to explain exactly what you're tasting, and they have really good taste buds to tell you which region it came from. I have good hands and good taste to tell you what the rice feels like and why it tastes good. So it's a little bit different side. We are doing a bunch of classes with sake sommeliers and trying to educate just regular people to understand how to pair foods with sake. Because I think that's the next biggest step, is how do you take some sake home and then how do you impress your friends? You put it with cheese? Yeah, maybe. Maybe you put it with cheese. Maybe you put it with nuts. Maybe you put it with some raw fish or oysters. It depends. So you want to know which sake goes well. And it is different. There's a lot of sommeliers, wine sommeliers, that come in, and they're shocked when they go through this dandelion pairing class because you should not have something that is savory go with sweet or sweet go with sweet. I mean, sake does some interesting combinations to the food.
Going back to your question on the temperature of the sake, mm-hmm. A lot of people's first experience with sake is this little bottle of hot sake. You wouldn't heat your sake, is that true, to that kind of temperature?
Sake can be heated. It absolutely is. You can have really good sake that's heated, not cooked. Okay, that's a real key difference here. And a lot of the sake that we grew up with in the 70s and 80s and 90s was overheated and left in the heater all day, so it just burned away any of the flavors you had. Namazake traditionally is not heated. We do have one restaurant, though, that warms it up just past room temperature. Mm-hmm. So it's not hot. Mm-hmm. It's just warmer than cold. And that is a really interesting flavor. He does that just for a specific dish that he's serving. So it pairs well with that dish. You know, it's an experiment. I mean, lots of the sake sommelier classes, they will take sake and they will start it with cold and work it all the way up through the different degrees, and you can actually taste it. Sake is really, really unique that way, that you actually have ability to change it. And the flavor profile changes. The texture changes. The viscosity of the product changes with temperature.
Hi.
Hello.
As a novice sake drinker, let's say, and I wanted to go sake tasting, mm-hmm. what should I look for other than those basic questions you answered earlier?
Okay. There's a lot of things you can look for. One of the big things I look for right away is when I pour it into a glass, is it yellow or is it clear? So sake has some enemies. One of the biggest enemies is iron. Second biggest enemy is sunlight. Third biggest enemy is oxygen. They will turn sake yellow and actually remove a lot of the flavor. So if it's yellow, if it's not aged sake, that's a new trend right now. There's a lot of aged sake. That is yellow. It tastes like sherry. But if you want fresh sake, it should be clear. It might have a slight greenish-yellowish tint, but it should not be yellow. It should not look like a Chardonnay.
Well, I think it's delicious.
Thank you.
Would you mind telling us what the retail price is of the three types of sake that you make?
The retail price is interesting, depending on where you go. The sake that you're drinking right there is a $7.50. It retails for about $33. We have the half bottle size, and they're about $18, depending on the stores that you go to. Mm-hmm. The Genshu is mm-hmm. not blended down. It's straight from the tank. That's about $36. And our nigori, which is the creamy or rough filtered sake, that's about $33 or $18 also for the half size. Okay. We will have a daiginjo coming out later this year, too. Great. Yeah.
Hi, I have two quick questions.
Sure.
Where do you see your business in 5 to 10 years? And, you know, do you have any plans to sell in other states, such as New York?
Another New Yorker. Okay. I'm actually doing this as a gateway to my retirement. So I'm going to grow this to a sustainable size that I feel comfortable dealing with. My whole reason to get into this business was to get a relationship to the customer and get this industry going. With that said, anything's open. We are talking to distributors. We probably won't be in New York this year, but hopefully sometime in the future. The problem with New York is it's a long ways to send Namasake. So we will be pasteurizing a product later this year that will be in distribution probably outside the Bay Area, just because there has been such a big demand for our product.
Well, it should be. Where do I go to buy this?
Well, let's see. I think I have that right here. So True Sake is the oldest only sake shop, and it's here in San Francisco. They have a great staff. They can tell you a lot about it. Buy Right, they have an incredible staff. They've gone through our training, and they actually have spent a bunch of money on getting their staff up to a good standard and sent a couple to sake sommelier class. Nijia, if you go there, that's here, and it's also in San Mateo and Mountain View. And Umami Mart, if you're over on the East Bay. And these guys are really wonderful. Common Sage, really great place. If you're way out in Sausalito, Kentfield, we have Woodland Mart. Healthy Spirits is nice. And Gus's Market has just come online. They're doing very, very well. And you also can always come to the brewery. We're over by Dogpatch. We actually are the mayor tells us we are now in Brewer's Gulch. We're just off of, we're actually the wholesale restaurant area. So we're off of Cesar Chavez over by Barnville. Yep.
From a taste perspective, can you kind of describe the difference between a lower end sake and a kind of a much higher end sake? What are the things that we should be looking for?
A lower-end sake is usually less milled, so it's usually about 70%. So you've got a lot of the protein still on there, and you also have possibly some of the minerals in there. So you'll actually have a very, you know, rough flavor. Usually the lower-end sake, they also pasteurize it, and they also will take it and put it through charcoal filters and some other processes to remove any of the proteins outside of the. So it becomes kind of a bland product. If you ever have drank any of the cooking sake, that's kind of what you're getting at. Premium sake really starts when you get at least 40% of the product out. So when you say ginjo, that's where you really start to taste the difference. And that from that point up, you're getting a cleaner flavor, and you're also probably getting, depending on the yeast that they use, either a floral or a fruit style.
You mentioned that your sake has a higher acidity, I think. And
yes.
Where is that coming from in the process?
It depends on let's step back for a second. So once I put all my ingredients into the main fermenter, it stays there for about 20, 25 days. I can only affect it in two ways. Sake is a cold fermentation process, so it's at about 50 degrees for that whole time. So I can only change the temperature or I can stir it. So the yeast loves oxygen, so the more I stir, the faster the yeast grows, okay? Koji doesn't like oxygen, so likes it to be cold. If I make it cold, the koji works faster, but the yeast works slower. So I'm trying to create this balancing act. It's actually the only parallel fermentation alcoholic product I know of. If I increase the speed of my yeast production, I will actually increase my acidity. So there's a subtle balance inside there that I'm watching and I'm monitoring every day to see where I'm headed with that.
Do you offer tours of your facility?
Thank you for asking that. My partner's going to kill me that I didn't mention this earlier. Yes, we're open on Saturday from noon till 6. We also, as you see the postcards there, we do private events and we have private tours. If you call and schedule a private tour, we'll give you a little bit more information. And we actually have two different levels of that. And we also have private events for corporations, too. So, yes.
Have you gotten any reaction to your sake from people in Japan?
We've had a lot of reaction to our sake from Japan. We actually had one of the top 10 brewmasters in last week and was blown away by it and said that if we did a blind taste test, he would not have known that this was an American-made sake. So we're very happy with that.
This is maybe taking things a little bit directly off topic, but you were in Japan for 10 years. What was your experience like? What places do you recommend for novices in sake drinking who are going from San Francisco over to Japan?
This is my second tour of Japan, as I like to call it. So my first one was I went to college in Japan when I was in college and spent a year there. Then I went back the second time with my wife and daughter. And these were two drastically different experiences. When I was there as a college student, I had no money, and we just went out and did what we could do with, you know, a few dollars in our pocket. When I was there with my family, because I had started my own company and my wife was working for a major corporation, she had to make sure she was at work every day. I had the flexible schedule, so I went to all the PTA meetings, all the other parts of that had to deal with the child care and everything like that. So I was lucky to get into the community. And once you get into the community, it's an incredible experience. In terms of drinking sake, I was also very fortunate to have met John Gartner when I first went over there, and he opened up the experience of where to go get good sake. So even though there's thousands and thousands of sakes, it's still a chore to find the kind of sake once you know what you want, where to find it, and where to shop for it. It's getting much better. The Namazake is actually growing in Japan in popularity, but it was still quite difficult when I first went back there. Just go and enjoy it. It's great. And food is fantastic. And you just talk to people. People will tell you. And you stop at a lot of different sake liquor shops and just say, hey, I'm looking for this kind of sake. I'm looking for that kind of sake. Where can I go? They're all really friendly, full of information for you. You do have to learn a little Japanese, though.
I think we have time for one last question. Any final questions from our audience?
So I'm from Japan, and I'm interested in bringing back a bottle. Mm-hmm. I'm going home next month to my sake-loving dad. So is it safe to bring it back on the plane or?
Yes, it is. We have special bags that you put the sake in and you put it in your suitcase and you're fine. In the planes, at this time of year, it's fine. It's just when you get to Japan, you need to get some dry ice or something, depending how far you're going.
And so I have to keep it in the fridge.
You need to keep it in the fridge.
And how long will it last?
3 months.
3 months.
Yeah.
Okay.
No problem. The Genshu is the best, the easiest one to travel because it's the full product. The Nigori is the most delicate one, so I would not suggest taking that. But once you get to Japan, you get a little dry ice, put it in the cooler, you're fine. You're good.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I think we all learned a great deal that we didn't know before we came here today. Thank you, Mr. Jake Myrick, co-founder of Sequoia Sake, for your enlightening comments today. And a special thanks to the Consulate General of Japan in San Francisco for co-sponsoring this program. And we also thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.